Hi, everyone. I'm Danny. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Danny.
And I hope that this works out. I will hold this. I'm only talking for 10 minutes. It doesn't matter. I'm nervous to be here tonight. I'm excited to be here tonight. I'm really, really excited to see a number of people who are here in their first 90 days. This was one of the first meetings that I ever attended in my first leave. My sobriety date is August 24th, 2013. And I was terrified of this meeting. Everyone seemed like they had been friends for years, like they had never crashed a car. I was so, you know, part of my condition is and always has been that when I walk into a room, I immediately feel like everyone is 5 minutes away from pulling out the knives that they all like got at the same knife party and like coming after me. And that's just my baseline. Like if I'm having a good day and I walk into a room, in my sort of natural condition, that's how I feel. That's not, I don't want to say a normal way to feel, because there's a lot of us here, I'm clearly not alone, but that's not a great way to feel. It doesn't make you walk into a lot of rooms comfortably. So when I did discover alcohol when I was 16, it wasn't just like, this seems like fun, it was, I can walk into rooms now. And so it felt really clear to me the first time that I got drunk, that this was the best thing that could have possibly happened to me. That anyone who got hurt or didn't like the way that I drank was threatening my safety and well-being, and I was going to treat them as such. Which meant that anyone who wanted to ask me questions about my drinking, cut me off, recommend that I not drive, try to talk to me about my behavior the next day, they were an enemy and I had to defeat them through whatever means I had to defeat them. And again, you know, the fact that I'm standing here, I think that tells you a little bit about how that worked and how well that went for me. I'm not very good at defeating the entire world every day. That's, you know, when I think about, like, why is it that when we come here, we can say things like, I'm totally powerless over alcohol without falling apart. And that to me was just because it was really obvious. It was really, really clear to me that the 13 years that I spent trying to fight the world every day, usually while falling down drunk, was going very, very badly. The world was winning. The world had been winning from day one. And so whatever it was that I had always thought or hoped that alcohol was doing for me required a lot of work to convince myself that things were going well. Like every day, generally speaking, I would wake up sick from what I had put in my body the day before. And that really gave me something to focus on, because that meant I had a plan for the rest of the day, which was fight this sickness off, and then ingest what you need to ingest to feel good for about a half an hour, and then get sick again, and then you have a new set of problems. And when you're out of it for a long, after you've been out of that life for a while, it can start to feel like, my God, that was exhausting, debilitating, horrifying, upsetting, unhealthy, and all of that. But at the time, it felt like this is the amount of intensity and motivation I need to make getting out of bed seem worth it. So every day, even really good days, even days where other things were going on, that's kind of what it was like. I experienced a lot of consequences for my drinking pretty early on. They did not bother me. I found ways around them. I decided I did not care about things that I used to thought I cared about. I decided to let go of them. They did not matter as much as getting to drink again did. So I would just kind of like surgically remove needs from my life. Because the one thing that I really needed to get through the day was drinking and using exactly the way that I wanted to. And as time went on, the way that I wanted to do it was to stop getting in trouble. Like I was like, I drink normally. I drink like anybody, any sane person would. I just happen to have the worst luck. If you give me a drink, like the bad luck god descends upon my life. Who, you know, what are the odds? How could the, you know, who could have seen this coming? Certainly not me. And it took a lot of pain and a lot of distress and a lot of despair for me to start to ask myself the question, what if I don't have the worst luck in the world? What if the reason the same thing happens to me every day is because of what I do every day? And what if that also means it's going to keep happening? And that felt really terrifying. So at that point, I thought, okay, I need to start drinking better. I'm really, really going to tackle this problem with all of my resources, with all of my willpower, with everything I've got. I know I'm a smart person. I know I'm a capable person. I'm gonna start really handling this. And that's when my drinking just, the floor fell out from under me. I did things I thought I would never do. I lost things I thought I would not lost. I had so long ago left behind like drunk driving. I was just drunk commuting. I thought that people who only drove drunk on the weekends and at night were incredibly together people. I thought they should be like getting interviewed for how they have such an incredible life. And it also just kind of stopped working. Like, I often couldn't drink the way that I wanted to, which meant I would have, like, four drinks and want to kill myself. Or I would black out for a couple of days at a time. And it just got worse and worse the harder I tried. So eventually I got to a point where I thought, I will Google what people do when they stop drinking, and I will see what turns up. And AA turned up, and I did not like that. I was scared, I was intimidated, and I came anyways kind of thinking, I'm just going to go take a look, I'll see what happens. What happened was I heard somebody who did not know me, whose life looked nothing like mine, talk about what it had felt like the first time they picked up a drink, and how it had immediately felt like life worked in a way it had not worked before. And I thought, I believe him when he says this. I think he really did have that experience. And as I continued to listen to him, I thought, I also believe that he's not doing that right now, and he doesn't seem like he wants to kill himself. Like, I could hold on to that much. I met my sponsor later that night. She took me through the first 12 steps. She encouraged me to be honest with her, which was new for me. She also did not go out of her way to beat me up when I fucked up. So when I, like, for the first time, had to call her and say, I lied to you about something, she said, okay, I figured. Here's what we do next. And that was not a response I had ever encountered in my life to fucking up. I knew how to hate myself. I knew how to blame somebody else, and I knew how to pretend something hadn't happened. That was it. Those were my three responses to something I did wrong. And what AA told me was, you're going to feel a lot of things. That's fine. Some of them will make you feel like you're going crazy. That actually doesn't need to stop you from doing the right thing. And if you do the right thing consistently enough, some of those feelings will be occasionally replaced by a moment of peace or a moment of calm, or an intuition about what's the right thing to do. And it wasn't like this promise that I was going to feel fantastic 100% of the time, but it was sort of don't worry about changing your feelings. They may or may not change. The point is you're going to continue to get a lot of them. They don't always give you the best information. And you need to find a power greater than just your own brain in order to access that kind of acceptance and that kind of serenity. And again, that to me felt profound, it felt new, and it also made some sense. One of the things that my sponsor encouraged me to do early was start sponsoring others. That's, I think, the thing that has most often kept me in a position of sanity when other things fail. Like, I often avoid calling my sponsor. I sometimes avoid going to meetings when I'm sponsoring someone. I do not click on them. Like, every time we meet, even if it's the last time we meet, even if they disagree with everything I say, I leave that feeling like, oh my God, I can't believe I talked about the thing that I was the most ashamed of. And it was useful to them. It was useful to another alcoholic. I don't have to just wish that that had never happened. I can turn it to good use. I'm so grateful for that. There's a lot that I've got to do in sobriety that I absolutely never would have done without it. And I have 1 minute left, so I will condense all of that. Mostly, I just want to say that I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk about my story here. I hope that if you heard something useful, that you can hang on to it. If you didn't, that maybe the next speaker will. And I'm just really grateful for the opportunity to not have, like, it's really awful to have to drive drunk every day. I didn't want to. I had to. I hated it. And now I don't have to. Now I just get to, like, get behind the wheel when I want to. I never had that before, and I'm grateful for it. I'm glad that I'm here tonight. Thanks.
My name's Erin. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Erin.
Can y'all hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to try this whole thing. So I think I just want to start with my intention, which is to speak to the newcomer. Welcome. We're so glad you're here. And in speaking to the newcomer, I think I want to call upon who I was as a newcomer. When I was a newcomer, I didn't, first of all, was repelled by AA because I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't think it was ever that bad. And it was that bad. Like, there are so many paradoxes. It wasn't that bad, and it was that bad. It was very corny. I thought, and the way AA and 12-step groups are depicted on TV just still make me cringe. And I just had so much judgment about the slogans, the words that we say. I had a lot of judgment around them. And today, I see that when I have judgment, I usually have fear. So it's usually a trigger. It triggers awareness for me to notice if I'm in fear. And let's see, what else? I couldn't sit still when I came to AA meetings. And when people said I keep coming back, I just grumbled and swore. I hated myself, and I couldn't take in the love that other people were offering to me. And I didn't trust it, and I felt really guarded. And so I stayed in the back room of the room for a really long time. And the other thing that kept me from wanting to, well, I wasn't a joiner. I wasn't going to join anything, especially, you know, a group of people who had some sort of solidarity. I just wasn't going to do that. And then the other thing was the God thing. It was hard for me to hear the word God without some pain. I grew up in a religious household and experienced some pain around God. And it wasn't because of, you know, quote unquote God, it was people. So I had a hard time hearing the God thing. But for the newcomers who had any of those experiences, particularly the God thing, there is a workaround. I don't believe in God, but I can say God, and I can have a spiritual life. So just want to put that disclaimer out there. My other intention is to allow God to work through me. That sounded very God-y, didn't it? I think I might be able to get into that later, but I think finally my intention is to not swear. Sometimes when I swear, I think I'm trying to be a little tougher than I am, or kind of maybe funny. And one of the things that I am kind of working on right now is, well, working on is looking at. We look at character defects. That's one of the things of the program. And I'm looking at negative humor as something that I've just thrived on for years. And it's getting to the point where it's a little bit more painful, and it's not as useful to me anymore. So I'm kind of coming into another layer of authenticity, and so I might not be very funny, but that's okay. You know, I think the first time I spoke at a meeting, it was at MPI, and the people were like, "Are you gonna be funny?" I was like, "No," and I wasn't. So so what it was like? I grew up in a family where only one person was allowed to have feelings, and it wasn't me. It was my father, and he had a problem with rage, and he said explicitly, "Stop crying." So, you know, as a kid, you know, crying, I was like, "Well, this is very confusing. I'm having these feelings. What do I do if I'm not supposed to cry?" So, I learned how to not cry and how to do other things. So instead of feeling, what do? Like, as a kid, I didn't drink beer at the time, so I was like, it was chocolate, it was watching TV. As I grew up, it was a lot of activities, exercising, it was sports, clubs, school. I had, as a 16-year-old, I had 3 jobs, and I was a member of a gym, and all these sports, so it's like I was doing a lot. And at school, I was busy, and at home, I didn't talk. I kind of became the problem, and I was brought to a psychologist who was like, "You need to emote." I was like, "I don't even know what that means," and just, you know, started crying because it just felt so oppressive. So I learned how to do other things rather than to feel, and that's my go-to. So when it came time to party as a high schooler, and I went to a school where it was There was a lot of proximity to different schools and different party scenes. So while I was an incredibly anxious young woman, teenager, I was, I went to them and there was alcohol, and I was gifted in the sense that, like, I could drink a lot. It was remarkable. And I was a girl, right? And throughout grade school and high school, I would get messages that girls can't do as much as boys can do, girls can't achieve as much, can't be, like, you know, you're not as good at. And so I felt it was like my duty to my sisters to drink the boys under the table. And I did. So that was like my gift to my, you know, sisters. And that was, and I drank like an athlete, like I was an Olympian drinker with the drinking games. And that was the fun part. And then besides that, it wasn't that fun. The fun part, the unfun parts were blacking out, not hearing rumors about myself and not knowing if they were true. So that kind of thing, it was easy enough to avoid by drinking more or doing too much and just, you know, not feeling those feelings and avoiding. So eventually I went away to school, and when I went away to school, I started learning about alcoholism and how it impacts the family system. And I saw the roles that me and my sisters played and the dynamics and how it played out. And at the same time, I started learning about religion and started to think about how, you know, the religion of my upbringing wasn't a club I wanted to be a part of. And I met with a priest who said, it's okay, you know, just look through different windows and see what window you want to be looking through. So it was just kind of like a search. And eventually I became depressed. And mental illness runs in my family, and alcohol is a depressant. And that was my track for a while. Eventually I moved out to California from the East Coast and got a job as a van driver, driving dually diagnosed clients to AA meetings, not knowing at the time that I myself was dually diagnosed or what even that meant. That was my intro to AA meetings, was driving people. And see, that I didn't know that you could go to a lot of different meetings and you know, find the ones that work for you. There was like one meeting we went to and drug deals went down in the back of the room. So it wasn't a great intro to AA, but it was, you know, exposure to what, that it was there. And, but usually when I left, I was like, oh, those poor alcoholics, they can't drink. And then I'd go to the store and grab a bottle of wine and drink it and then cause havoc in my community. So, so that was that layer. And I don't want to spend too much time on the drunkenness, because it's actually infinitely more boring to me than sobriety. So I just want to get quickly to the end of it. I was the crazy girl in the sense that, like, you know, depressed and eventually wanted to, didn't want to live, but I was too depressed to actually take action and try to actually kill myself. So I would just, you know, wander the street and hope I get hit by a bus. And I was at the time dating someone who was worse than I was, and he thought I was worse than he was. And we went to couples counseling and we said as much to each other. He ended up going to AA, and then a few weeks later, I was like, I had the best time in AA. It was better than like the last 4 years of my life. I'm like, excuse me. We were together for the last 4 years of your life. So then I just wanted to check out what this AA was about. So people were actually having fun. There were young people, they were partying, they were dancing, they were camping. But I didn't want to be a joiner. One day I just kind of said, hey, I'm a newcomer. People were super excited. And looking back, those first 4 years of sobriety, I think I was holding on to my power. I was working the steps, I was sober, but I still thought it wasn't that bad. So I decided, you know what, I'm going to start drinking again. And I did. And I got angry pretty quickly and sad pretty quickly. And And I think I could probably say in a intimate women's meeting the incomprehensible demoralization and the shame that that period of time brought me to. But the shame brought me to a place where I wanted to drive into a brick wall. So again, I had these passive thoughts of killing myself, and they scared me enough to want to come into AA again, but not enough to make me want to join. I mean, this time that I came into AA, I was so angry, so cold, and so dismissive. And people were lovely and loving and welcoming. And I just had to be this icy cold person for 2 years. I sat in the back of the meeting. I came late and I left early and I didn't talk to anyone. And but what I can say is that I met a sponsor. I went to a meeting, and it was before going to a goodbye party for a friend who was leaving. My last friend was leaving the Bay Area. And so I met this woman at an AA meeting in San Francisco, and I was like, I'm going to a bar, I'm going to drink, don't think you're going to try to stop me. She's like, right on, just notice what happens. And that attracted me. I didn't want anyone telling me what to do. I didn't want anyone scared of me or offering me too much. I just wanted someone to say, just notice. And what I noticed was that I was alone at a party. I was angry at the bartender for giving me a warm beer. And I was just like covered in, you know, barbecue beans or whatever. And I had, you know, puffy beer face. And I didn't want to do it anymore. And while I thought that I could control my drinking to some extent, I couldn't control the effects of it. So I couldn't control the emotions that that evolved from my drinking. Couldn't control whether or not I was going to get angry, if I was going to feel lonely, if I was going to feel numb. And, you know, when you really dig into it, I couldn't control how much I was drinking. I've told myself a number of times, like, I don't want to drink, but oh, never mind, I'm going to. Part of the disease is forgetting these agreements that we make with ourselves. And I would forget how I felt. And it was convenient to forget. So while I thought I had control, and while to some extent I probably still do feel like I have control, I know that I don't. So I'm powerless. And I got that. And that person that I met at that meeting gave me a business card. It was like a flirt card with a glamour shot on it. And I was like, what is up with these people? And I called her, and we started working the steps. And it was, and I love her. I've been working with her for 12 years, 10 months, and 2 weeks about. And I called her last week on my knees about life. And somehow she says things that I can hear. There are sometimes people can say things that I can't hear it at all, and she says things that I can hear. And yeah, so what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So let me think here, because am I whipping through my time? How am I doing on time?
You got 25 minutes left.
Cool, because sobriety is infinitely more interesting than the drunk part. Okay, I just want to talk about steps here. So step one, powerless. We admitted we are powerless over alcohol and our lives were unmanageable. So I talked a little bit about powerlessness. First of all, when I first heard this step, I was like, what? What does that even mean? Powerless over. So what it means to me is I can't control my drinking, and I can't control the effects of my drinking. That's what that means to me. And my life is unmanageable. It's pretty easy for me to admit that my life's unmanageable, and that there's a level of insanity that that I'm not willing to live with. And really when it comes down to it, I kind of have this, like, or had this facade of this tough guy. You know, and actually in college, my nickname was Tough Guy, Toby for short. And I'm really not that tough. I don't like pain. And so the pain that came from the shame, especially, the shame of drinking, and behaviors and compulsive behaviors, I just was too much for me. So it's easy for me to say my life's unmanageable and I don't want to live with this. Hard to come in to AA, but yeah. I backtrack a little bit. After 2 years, this time around, I got this service commitment as a child-friendly service coordinator. And those kids scared the crap out of me. I was so scared of kids, and part of it was that they were honest. So frightening. You know, usually adults are civil with each other, they're polite, and they totally lie to your face. But kids will say, this little girl's like, I like your scarf. And I was like, thanks. And she's like, can I see it? I said, okay. So I gave it to her, and she just like stepped on it. And I was like, that's just probably my biggest fear, and it's not that bad. So I took on this commitment for almost 2 years, and I love these kids, and I got to know their moms, and I got to know the group, and it just like melted the ice around my heart. That was the commitment that opened my heart and got me to thinking, like, do I want to be a mom? So anyway, that's all my story. So step one. Powerless, life's manageable. Okay, step two. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. So, yeah. That's a big one. A power that greater. So I came in and couldn't do the God thing. But what I could do was I could say, the sun is a power greater than me, the wind, the moon, the ocean, the waves, nature, the way of nature, life. Like, these forces are powers greater than me. And then I could extend it a little bit further and say, these moments of synchronicity where, like, for example, once I went to a party where I was in a relationship that was super messed up. And I was, I wanted to drink. And I think I probably was like, okay, God, you know, help me if you're going to help me. And this woman from AA, you know, showed up. So there was these enough moments of synchronicity to say, okay, maybe there's a force that's a little bit, you know, I could, maybe there's a force of like goodness and beauty and truth and justice and love and kindness. And maybe that force is just kind of this layer behind all of us as we sit here. And it's kind of something that I can believe in. So came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. Can it restore me to sanity? Well, I know that when I get quiet in the morning, when it's the sun's about to come up, there's a certain force to that that can restore me to sanity. I know that when I open my heart to what this program offers, I can receive the loving goodness and kindness of the fellowship. So yeah, I think that there are probably some examples that show that it can restore me to sanity. So with the God thing, like, I can say God, and I might mean like this mysterious benevolent force. Or benevolent mysterious force, BMF for short. But I still can't listen to certain like religious talk. I still can't say certain prayers, and that's okay. So, you know what? We're where we are at, and I guess there must be some fear still there. You know, because again, when I notice that I make judgment, it usually means that there's some sort of fear. So I have some judgment about some prayers, I can't say them, and that's okay. I got some fear. So it might be something that I can work the steps around. So that's my step two. Step three.
made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood God. So this step kind of gives me it's me making a commitment to align myself with that power. So making a decision to turn my will and my life. Just I'm committing to align myself with this force of goodness and truth and beauty and love and kindness. So that's the third step. And here's how interesting life is. I'm going to be like, oh, it's my spiritual life today. I'm not spiritual because I'm just like, oh, I'm so spiritual. I'm spiritual because I'm crazy and I want to be sane. I'm spiritual because it hurts and I don't want to feel pain. I'm spiritual because I don't know how to be in this world. So I get on my knees to ask for help and I receive it. So here's my morning. This is like the ideal day. Is my ideal spiritual day, which doesn't happen, by the way, all the time. But on some good mornings, I can swing it. So I wake up and I say the first three steps in my head, and I usually apply it to whatever it is, alcohol, which I haven't been triggered by for a long time. Thank you, God. Sometimes I do have triggers and think about it, but there are other things that trigger me too, like food or people. So I worked it around my family. And there's something super gnarly happening in my family right now, and I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to be, but I can work. But when I say the first three steps, and like I just feel it, I feel the third step in my body. I can just give it. I can give it. I can surrender it, and it feels better. And somehow, like without that much tension, I'm a little bit more able to hear or to know next what happens. So I say the first three steps in my head, and then I say the third step prayer. Now the third step prayer is like, for a while I've been saying it, and I just spend so much time trying to figure out what the heck it's even trying to say. So I ended up rewriting it. You can do that. There are lots of workarounds in AA. You can do it. So I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as what you will. What the heck does that mean? So it just means I'm here to do your will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Remove my affliction so I can be useful. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help with that power, that love, and that way of life. And so that I can point to you as the solution for people who still suffer. It's like the Steph Curry of AA prayers. So like when Steph Curry makes a shot from like half court, he touches his heart and then he points to it. So that's like the third step prayer. It's like, you know what? I'm just going to touch my heart and point to this guy. It's not me. It's God. It's good. It feels really good. I might do a little dance, but it's really not me. It's God. So I can point to you as a solution for people who still suffer. May I always do that will. So I just kind of like had to break the prayer down so that I understood it. So that's the third step prayer. And then I meditate, but I start. Oh, okay. So meditation. When I first started 12 steps, like 20 years ago, and that's even before I got to AA, I had a sponsor who encouraged me to start with meditating, even before doing all the steps. And a lot of times people would be like, you know what, steps are important for a reason. But, you know, you can be on a step. You can always, like, meditate. You don't have to believe in God to meditate. It can just be noticing your breath. Noticing the thoughts that come, and then like I think a lot of times people get really, really frustrated with themselves that their thoughts are moving, and it's kind of like your brain is a puppy. Come here, puppy. Come on back. So just like come on, puppy. Come on back. So throughout the whole this whole like journey of recovery, my spiritual like practices and
have changed, because it's going to be dynamic. It's just going to keep changing, and I'm going to, you know, go to things that seem really interesting. And, you know, if you want it to be super exciting, there's, you know, Kundalini yoga and tantric sex practices, or you could just kind of sit there and be like, notice your thought, you know, and go back to your breath. So I went to one meditation thing where it had you, like, ground your chakras, ground each chakra, and then I ended up, like, creating a prayer that helped me to ground my chakras, and so here's that one. It's what I call is, like, a grounding meditation. And so imagine, like, going through the top of your head through each chakra, and then rooting and saying these as you go through each chakra. Ground my being that I may take root in your goodness. Fuel my power that I may act with kindness. Steady my balance that I may emanate grace. Enter my heart that I may exude love. Purify my expression that I may convey truth gently. Cleanse my vision that I may see beauty clearly. Calm my mind that I may rest easily. Integrate these gifts that I may offer them freely. Surround my spirit with your protective peace. And please be with me today in all that I do, think, see, say, and feel. And then I meditate. I just, like, get quiet for a minute. Or if somebody's on my mind or in my heart, I hold them in my heart. And then usually my 3-year-old jumps on me. and then I hold on to him, and I meditate with him. And we just sit quietly together. Another meditation that I do is 2 or 3 times a week I run around the lake and I try to wake up to beauty and gratitude throughout the run. I'll try to kind of achieve 12 is a special number, 12 moments of gratitude or beauty. Sometimes it's just beautiful out. It's like Mary. It's blue skies, sunny days, ducks. But sometimes, like, it's kind of stinky, and sometimes somebody gives you a dirty look, and sometimes it's not that beautiful. Gray skies, and when I wake up to that is when it's most important to find gratitude. So that moment of, like, oh, they gave me the stink eye. You know, what's my gratitude in that is that, wow, I used to be really sensitive to that. And that's not a thing for me anymore. And that I can hold that person in my heart. I can feel grateful for that, or I can extend some sort of love or kindness. Or maybe I'll see something that just doesn't feel or seem right, and it seems like injustice, and maybe I don't know what to do, but that desire to know or desire to act is there, and I can be grateful for that. So that sort of helps me in my life, because, say, for example, like, actually, I'm just going to kind of keep going. I have just a few more minutes left.
About 9.
Okay. The other part of my spiritual practice throughout the day is to reach out to people. I used to never call people. Certainly not to talk about my feelings, but I do that now. And the phone is a lot lighter than it used to be because I made it a practice too. And the other thing that I do is when I am so perplexed and usually angry and resentful and emotional, I write a 10th step and I call my sponsor. And I find ways to manage life. And then I also write, and I have this, oh God, once I called someone, and I was like, oh, I'm just going to make a program call, and I got to out myself, because I'm a jerk, and I thought,
wow, you know, I'm going to call this person. She's not going to be able to offer me much, you know, because she's whatever. So she told me about this thing called a feelings wheel. And I got so excited about that. She says she writes about her feelings every morning by looking at this feelings wheel. And that helps her to not act out on her behaviors and compulsions. And yeah, that's the thing, is that this whole spiritual thing is to, part of it, pretty much all of it for me, is to be able to manage these feelings that I wasn't allowed to feel. And I'm learning how to feel in, middle age. And that is amazing. That's kind of a miracle. So there are the promises, right? One of the promises is, we intuitively know how to handle things which used to baffle us. Are these extravagant promises? Yeah, like I think that's a really extravagant promise. But I kind of understand that promise a little bit more now. Is that when I first heard that promise, what I thought it meant was, I'll just be able to walk through the world and know what to do at all times. And that's not exactly what it's saying. I think what it's saying is, I can pause and I can feel this anxiety, this tension that I have with the discomfort of not knowing. And I can take a breath and I can do all these spiritual things and I can wait for that answer to come to me. And that's what's happening. So if that's what that means, that promise has come true for me. So what's happening with my family right now, my parents are in a situation which could involve social services, could involve the police, it could involve the hospital, it could involve all these things, and I would love to help. And it's not working. So that's, there's a whole other program for that. But I can sit with that discomfort, and I can ask for the next right thing, and I can reach out for help. And it looks from the outside like I'm walking through it gracefully. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like that. I'm I don't know what to do. But when other people, are looking, it's like, wow, she knows what she's doing. Okay. So just a little before and after, I was a fixer-upper. I was a crazy girl. I was not open to receiving help didn't want to receive help. But in this program, we learn that it's okay to receive help inside and outside of the program. And so I have a mental illness, and I do take medication, and there have been times when I've told myself, I don't want to, for all of these reasons, and I'll give you a dozen. And then eventually I got to the point where I was on my knees thanking God that it was an option. Thank you that it's even an option, because when my grandmother was my age, she was hospitalized for 10 years. And so thank you, God, that this is an option and that I can have a peace and a freedom in my mind and heart. So outside help is okay. I went straight to a substance or a behavior instead of having a feeling. And I'm starting, my feelings, like actually experiencing my feelings, is starting to get a little bit closer to the event. Sometimes it's like really, really close to the event, and I'm like, yay for me! Like I'm crying, and yay! That I'm having a feeling, and then it's matching appropriately what's happening. I was depressed and super negative. I thought, I do not want to bring a child into this despicable world, and I judge people who do and who are on the conveyor belt of life, and like it's just all this negative judgment. And while all that might be the case in people's mind, like, I ended up getting married. Like, I never thought I'd get married. I married a guy who I would not have been attracted to before, but like, I changed enough to be attracted to like the nice ones and the happy ones. He was happy. I was like, what is up with this guy? And he's into me. But there were enough synchronicities to be like, okay, like I could be open to it. And I was talking to a sponsor who was like, just give it a shot. So we ended up having a baby together, this cute little 3-year-old who was like totally 3, and it's the coolest thing ever. It is so cool. Like, if I were to have regrets, I would regret like not doing it sooner and having more of them, you know, but one's enough. So like, not only am I not depressed, dare I say I'm happy a lot of the time. Maybe not. Like, maybe I can say I can have a lot of feelings at the same time. I can have multiple feelings, and I'm like just a more full human individual, and I can like thank this program for this. The 12 steps is like this framework to live a life with feelings and with the, you know, I can say some swear words, I'm not gonna. And I'm just eternally grateful for people being here. When I first came, there was a woman who said, you know what, smiling is an act of service. Because I wouldn't smile. And while I wouldn't tell someone to smile when they didn't feel it authentically, I'm grateful to say that I can smile authentically now. That it's like, that is true. And that, you know, I would encourage people to move through the steps so that they can have the ability to smile again. And that's what recovery is finding who we actually are underneath all this like piss and crap and, you know, blackouts and rumors and shame, you know, to find who we are and to be able to smile again. Thank you.